drifting off to sleep with Sid Vicious.
A lot much more than this. I've lived my way.
It's an old problem, getting babies to sleep. And moms today have some new solutions that they say work better than some traditional lullabies. Have it your way.
But then again, to future
on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, December 9th, and I think I'm developing a slight headache. But by the way, John, dads sing lullabies, too.
That's true. Sid Vicious could have been a dad. Good morning, Adora.
And we'll have more about that story, actually. And we're also going to look at the unusual development in the terror trials at Guantanamo Bay. And more than 1 in 10 Americans is currently using food stamps. We'll take a look at that program, too. Those stories are coming up. First, these headlines.
Harry Reid, the House Majority Leader, didn't sound happy yesterday talking about the auto bailout. Perhaps Sid Vicious and the Sex Pistols music was in his headphones somewhere.
We must act not to reward the executives of the Big Three for their failures, but to invest in the millions of Americans who could face the consequences of their failures.
They're worried about the excess of the auto industry and the deal kicking around Congress and the White House that could provide $15 billion in loans to the Big Three is not a sure thing. Lawmakers are demanding accountability. The current idea is to hire a so-called car czar, a cop watching how automakers use the taxpayer money. We'll get the latest on all this and hear some of your suggestions for a different name than car czar from Detroit and Washington in just a moment. Electronics giant in another economic story, Sony will cut 8,000 jobs, 5% of its global workforce. 10% of Sony's plants will shut down.
And here's a story about some workers who are fighting back, so to speak. A meeting today could be pivotal in resolving the workers' sit-in at a Chicago factory that's gotten international attention. The workers have been occupying a factory, fighting for severance and unused vacation pay. The company and Bank of America blame each other for the unpaid workers. The company claims they can't pay because the bank canceled financing. In a sign, Bank of America may be losing the PR battle. Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich leaned on them.
We hope that this kind of leverage and pressure will encourage the Bank of America to do the right thing for this business, take some of that federal tax money that they've received and invest it by providing the necessary credit to this company so these workers can keep their jobs.
The workers' union, the company, and the bank all meet today. A prior meeting didn't break the impasse. A routine military flight took a horrible turn that killed at least three people and forced an entire neighborhood to evacuate. The American fighter jet crashed into a San Diego home after the pilot ejected. Neighbors fled toxic fumes from the wreckage. The Pentagon isn't sure what went wrong with the flight.
The Dow and Wall Street are poised to open positively or flat this morning. And if you don't like Sid Vicious as a lullaby candidate, what's your suggestion?
I'm calling with something I used to sing to my son when he was little. And it's an old Peter Pan Mary song. I'm in love with a big blue frog.
I'm in love with a big blue frog.
What child sleep songs are you in love with in the new century? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Did you hear the enthusiasm in the voices of lawmakers on Capitol Hill hammering out the final details of a $15 billion bailout for the auto industry?
Unless the restructuring that is called for in this legislation and the goal of viability is achieved by March 31st, there is no justification for spending any more taxpayer dollars.
sounding a little like a substitute teacher and apparently holding her nose, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi talked about the conditions attached to the $15 billion. If it's finally approved, and that's not absolutely clear, there may be a car czar appointed by President Bush in the remaining days of 08. Joining us to talk about all these details is Todd Zwillick from Capital News Connection. He joins us from Washington. Also with us is Bill Vlasic, Detroit Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Todd and Bill, thanks for being a part of the program.
Thank you.
Hi, good morning.
So, Todd, let's begin with you. The negotiations are still going on. We've got things like car czar in the works. We've got $15 billion in the works. What remains to be done?
Well, there are a couple of they've got what they're calling a good framework with details to be worked out. Now, whenever a member of Congress tells you that, just don't, you know, assume that they're going to necessarily reach agreement. But they look – everybody is sounding the right notes, and they look like they're headed towards the good place. So what the White House still objects to, apparently, in the draft that was circulated by House Democrats yesterday, one of the things Democrats want is there are several lawsuits going on in about 18 states car companies challenging the state's rights to regulate greenhouse gases. And there are lawsuits in a lot of those states. And the Democrats do not want car companies that take taxpayer money to be able to challenge those lawsuits and sue the federal government. Essentially, they want those suits dropped. One of the other provisions that the White House is objecting to is a provision in that draft that would require permission from the car czar, or whatever you want to call him, for any transaction over $25 million that these companies make while they're on the taxpayer dime.
So that would include compensation issues, all kinds
Correct.
Of things. I mean, if you throw in the environmental regulations that are in court and the compensation questions, this car czar is going to have a lot to do. Bill Vlasic, in Detroit, what are they waiting to hear? And is this March 31st abstract notion of viability for the big three something realistic from your perspective?
Well, obviously, the companies are in no position to negotiate. They need this money so badly, General Motors and Chrysler. I think there's a guarded optimism. They're kind of holding their breath right now because General Motors in particular is skating on the edge right now and will run out of money in a matter of weeks. So how the bill is structured, what the requirements are, and even whether or not they have to prove that it's working and they're making progress by March 31st, they are willing to try and do whatever Washington requires of them to get this cash.
Okay, Bill, let's talk about some of the specifics. The idea of a car czar, what do you think?
Well, this isn't any surprise that there would be oversight. And, in fact, General Motors kind of preempted this by saying we'd like an oversight board. I think that was just a practical matter on their part. They knew they were going to get it. How it works is going to be play itself out. I do understand that trying to approve every $25 million transaction at these car companies is going to keep this gentleman or woman very, very, very busy because these are enormous companies. But the right person, I think, could be, in my opinion, could be helpful because these companies sometimes do need they're used to doing things their way. Obviously, a lot of those things haven't worked out that well. So having an intelligent and energetic czar could be a very positive thing.
Wanted intelligent and energetic person to be car czar. Todd Zwillick, any indication anyone would want this job? And how happy are you with the name here?
Well, some names have been thrown out. Ken Feinberg, who was a lawyer for 9/11 compensation, was thrown out there. Barney Frank slapped that one down, said the press invented it. That may or may not be true. So we don't know who it's going to be. We do know that they don't need Senate confirmation. But it probably will be – the person will be picked probably in concert with the transition team, the Obama transition team, because they don't want the person just to get fired so that Obama can hire somebody new. So,
I mean, it's hard to find experienced czars. Maybe we should think of a different name, Todd.
Well, that's true, and this is a question. You know, let's invite listeners to come up with their own name for the car czar today. I think people should call in, email in. You know, I've got a couple of suggestions. There's some names kicking around Capitol Hill yesterday.
Are you taking over the program, Zwillick?
I'm sorry. Excuse me, Todd Zwillick.
Are you taking over the program? So wait, you want to invite listeners to come up with a new name for car czar?
I think it's a good idea, don't you guys think so? I mean, I'm not trying to get on your territory, but I think it's a fine idea for people to do that.
Bill, what do you think?
I'm not sure that many people know what a czar is anymore, to tell you the truth. I did think some of the sort of these high-profile retired CEO names that were thrown out were not realistic. Guys like Jack Welch, I'm not so sure they're going to be willing to put their reputation on the line on trying to make the auto industry work. Mm-hmm. It might be just a recipe to ruin that reputation. My expectation is it's going to be someone who isn't well-known, but perhaps has some very strong political connections, and more importantly, is someone who is going to be there for a while, because, frankly, this is going to take a while.
All right. Well, then call in, listeners. 877-8-MY-TAKE. If you either are a czar, if you want to have a different name maybe for this position, if you can think of something better than car czar, it does rhyme, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or my take at the takeaway.
As if rhyming is significant. Yeah. Todd, let me ask you, let's talk about the Senate Republicans. We've read a lot about how much resistance there is. What's happening with Senator Mitch McConnell, and is there a sense that they will go along with whatever the deal ends up looking like?
Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, is playing those cards close to the chest. He came to the floor yesterday and kicked things off and said that taxpayers have to be protected, that nothing will go forward unless taxpayers are protected. Now, he has not then come out and said secondarily whether he thinks this draft, this bill, accomplishes that. So we're expecting to hear from him at some point today, perhaps tomorrow, whether or not he's going to support this bill. And if he does, that will send very strong signals to the rest of the Republican conference. The other senator to watch is, of course, Richard Shelby of Alabama, who's the ranking member on the Banking Committee, has been very, very vocal in his opposition to these bailouts, banking bailouts, auto bailouts, Fannie Freddie takeovers. Don't expect him to vote for it. Whether or not he mounts a filibuster and delays this thing also remains to be seen.
Bill Vlasic, $12 billion, $15 billion, whatever the amount is that they come up with, the three automakers are going to be using this money very, very differently. I sense a lot of desperation on the part of GM, which you already alluded to. Bob Lutz spoke on television yesterday saying he doesn't care where the money comes from, just get it to us now. Are Chrysler and Ford going to be doing anything different with this money?
Well, I don't believe Ford is going to be taking any of this money initially. They, as you probably remember, they asked for a line of credit going forward and aren't necessarily needed right now. But Chrysler's in a very similar position to General Motors. They are running out of cash. They need to pay suppliers at the end of the month. They need to pay their employees. They have immediate cash needs. So I don't think it's going to be any problem for them to find the money. GM has not been able to borrow money in the private market for quite some time at anything less than about 20%. So this is manna from heaven for them. And in some respects, they have to be careful they don't use it up too quickly.
Well, the community there, and on the front page of your paper yesterday, Bill, and I don't know if you saw this, Todd, there's a church service with two hybrid SUVs up on the altar. I mean, combined with the political situation there in Detroit, it just seems like Detroit is in the worst possible sort of emotional situation right now.
Our churches in Detroit are a very big part of the political scene and the social scene, and having three hybrid SUVs up on the altar may seem a little out there for people around the country, but frankly, it doesn't surprise me. People are, they're praying for this, and in many ways, I think that is one of the strengths of this town and this industry is that you can knock them down, but they're always ready to get back up.
Well, they're going to keep praying there in Detroit. Bill Vlasic, Detroit Bureau Chief of the New York Times, thanks for joining us. Also, Todd Zwillick of Capital News Connection. Can you imagine anyone calling up to change the name of the cars are?
Hi, John and Dodora. This is David from Putnam, Connecticut. Hey, I got the acronym for you. I think it should be NAG, National Automotive Guru.
And he wasn't the only one.
Hey, this is Ro from Cape Cod. How about Motor General?
Keep them coming. 877-8-MY-TAKE or my take at thetakeaway.org. You don't like cars are? Come up with an alternative.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. So here's a question. What are some of the songs the parents of today are using to put the leaders of tomorrow to sleep?
Sleep My Child, which I also heard from a Paul Robeson album. Sleep My Child goes like this. Sleep My Child and peace attend thee all through the night.
Sleep suggestions from you at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. No rockabye babies for this generation.
Not to be smug, John, but we have had several dads who have called in with the songs that they sing to their children or have sung
to
their
children. I'm on to dads.
We're going to move on to terrorism now. There was some drama in a court yesterday at Guantanamo Bay when the five men charged with plotting the September 11th terrorist attacks told the court they wanted to enter guilty pleas and make full confessions. The audience, for the very first time, included families of several 9/11 victims. Led by the supposed mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the five men were told their request would have to wait. Alan Gomez, a reporter for USA Today, is there. He joins us from Guantanamo Bay. Good morning and welcome back, Alan.
Good morning, guys.
Well, that certainly was a bit of a surprise, at least for many in the audience. What was the reason that they gave, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed gave, for wanting to confess?
Well, it was definitely a surprise. We were actually down here for what should have been a regular week of motion hearings leading up to their trials, but apparently the five of them had gotten together back in November and made this request to the judge. Their reasons were just that they were tired of the hearings. They were tired of the motions. They were tired of going through the entire process and just wanted to get on with it, plead their guilt, and move forward towards whatever was in store for them.
Now, the judge's response was actually interesting, indicating a thorough review would have to be made before that would be allowed. And it's a little bit hard to understand how some customary rules of evidence apply in this proceeding and others don't. What's the process now?
The process now, first off, is there are two of them that their mental health is in question. So they want to complete their mental health evaluations. They want to ensure that they are competent to not only represent themselves but to enter these guilty pleas. And then beyond that, they have to lay down what can be viewed as a standard sort of factual basis for accepting a guilty plea. They have to lay out what they did. They have to explain that they are willing and they understand the rights that are afforded to them but are still willing to accept this guilty plea. And then there's an open question of whether a jury has to be there to accept the guilty pleas. Because this is a capital case, all of them face the death penalty. So they have to figure out that little bit of military commission law before they can move forward.
So a lot to do, which is why the judge indicated that it's not in the detainees' near future that they're going to get this opportunity. I was also struck by this notion that Mohammed somehow was influencing the others. Do you want to explain that?
Well, that's been a contention from defense attorneys for the other four for months and months now. The way it's set up, especially during these court hearings, they are sitting at separate tables, but they are all sitting on the same side. So they're able to talk, they're able to pass notes. Actually, yesterday they were passing a laptop back and forth, kind of exchanging information. And what the defense attorneys for the others say is that whenever they get together, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, as he was before, is still very much the ringleader, the one who's kind of running the show, intimidating them. And there were, as you can see throughout the hearing, at first they all said that they wanted to plea, that they were ready to go. But once they saw that they weren't going to be able to do that, that a couple of them had to have their mental health evaluation and so forth, then all of a sudden they all shifted course and as a group said they wanted to, delay this. They wanted to put it off until they could all plead together. So it was definitely, as one of them put it actually during the hearing, it was a joint strategy. As they contend, it's all still coming from Muhammad.
Alan, I hesitate to take a step away from procedure here because it's almost impossible to know what is knowable about any of these defendants. But if they do get a chance to confess, are we likely to learn anything from those confessions? Do you have any sense that these people contain information that would be of broader interest? Or is it going to be a kind of hold your nose sort of, yeah, we wanted to kill a bunch of people in New York, the end, just to move things forward?
Well, that's, as with many other things with these military commissions, that's one of the things we're still kind of curious to see how it's going to work. Traditionally in these things, they have to lay out a factual basis. They have to show that the evidence that they would have presented at trial would have been proven. So that's kind of what some of us are waiting to see. There is obviously a lot of things that they're charged with that they can't discuss in open court. A lot of the things that they are accused of doing or saying is still classified. So there may be a lot of portions of even a guilty plea session where it's blacked out to folks in the media and folks in the public. So whenever that may come, it's still going to be a very interesting hearing.
Last question, Alan. How many family members of victims were there, and how did they react to what happened?
Well, there was 5 relatives that were each able to bring somebody with them, so there was 9 of them total. And as you can imagine, it was an incredibly emotional day for them. Seeing these people for the first time in their lives, some of them expressed some relief in hearing these guys take responsibility for what happened to their mothers and their children. But at the same time, they were very angered to see that here the United States was going to great lengths to try to give them some fair trials, to give them the due process, to allow them to make statements like reaffirming their allegiance to Osama bin Laden in open court, mm-hmm. and not being punished. And yet they were, in their view, from the relatives' view, they were mocking the proceedings by saying, this is a waste of our time, let's move on with it. So it was a kind of a mixed bag. They were, like I said, very relieved, but at the same time they were very upset to see them being given all these rights and yet sort of tossing them aside and saying that they just wanted to move forward and, be done with all this crazy due process stuff.
Very complicated stuff. Alan Gomez, thank you.
Thank you.
Alan Gomez is a reporter for USA Today, and he was reporting from Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And now we turn to Femi Okeh, who's reporting from right here in New York City with the headlines.
Thank you very much. 29 minutes past the hour is the time. No matter what you think of the car czar, a top-ranking GM executive likes it. Robert Lutz, who's a GM vice president, says that he's happy with a plan being discussed by Congress. 5 Blackwater guards have been charged with multiple counts of manslaughter in Washington. 17 civilians died when the guards opened fire in Baghdad last fall. The 15-year-old boy killed by police in Greece will be buried today. Athens has seen riots 3 nights in a row following the teenager's death this weekend. And new census data from around the U.S. shows that things are really bad all over the country. The recession has hit the Midwest the hardest. And that's a look at some news making headlines this morning.
Many thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. If you go to our website, thetakeaway.org, it's rare to have somebody saying that we're putting people to sleep on the program. But for the next segment, we're actually going to give it a shot, all right?
The song I typically sing to my daughters is I Will by the Beatles.
Who knows how long I've loved you? You know I
still. Lullabies for a New Age. What do you murmur or belt out to your child? Paul McCartney's crooning or something along the lines of Guns N' Roses. Call us with your goodnight songs at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And joining us now is Lisa Belkin from the New York Times, who writes the hugely monster motherload blog on the New York Times website all about motherhood. And the issue of lullabies came up on that blog recently, and that's why we invited Lisa Belkin to come in. I should remind everyone that Lisa is also the host of Life's Work with Lisa Belkin on Sirius XM Satellite Radio and is the author of the book Life's Work, Confessions of an Unbalanced Mom. I just wanted to say unbalanced mom before I said hello to you, Lisa. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, and yes, and a bit unbalanced at the moment, so that's appropriate, yes.
Well, tell us about this lullabies project that you sort of backed into, but with some very interesting results.
I found it on a blog in Britain, and they had asked their readers, and 2,000 people responded. I figured if 2,000 people were interested in Britain, let's see what the Americans have to say. And the idea was, what do you sing to your children? It's not, you know, Rock-a-bye Baby anymore. What is it? And it's a lot of pop songs.
And, first of all, what were some obvious suggestions? What were some unusual suggestions? And there were some on here that just don't seem like they evoke sleep at all.
Yeah. Some of them would wake me up, but that's neither here nor there. And the lyrics of many were very inappropriate, and the parents knew that. There's a lot of discussion on the blog about, well, they don't really understand, do they? And the rhythm's good. But a lot of the things that we've been singing to babies forever are not terribly appropriate. Right. I mean, that cradle falls down.
Yeah, exactly. And Ring Around the Rosie is about the plague.
Absolutely. So we're singing new inappropriate songs to kids, but a lot of them were, if you look at a love song, it really is appropriate between mother and child. They're not written that way, and I'm not talking Barry White, but most love songs sung by a parent to a child take on a whole new meaning.
Well, some suggestions.
Some say a lot of Beatles.
A lot of Beatles.
Beautiful Boy was huge. In My Life was big. A lot of Broadway, which is interesting.
What sort of Broadway?
We've got Beautiful Boy back there, don't we?
Oh, yeah, we got all kinds of music. We are fully staffed here.
There was a whole discussion between two women about a bushel and a peck and why their parents sing it to them and how they didn't know what a bushel and a peck were when they were little. They thought it was a hug and a kiss, and they came to understand in middle school that it was a measurement. Lullaby of Broadway was a big one, and I'm surprised that parents today know it because we're talking some young parents on there.
Well, let's pull back for a second and listen to A Bushel and a Peck from Guys and Dolls.
A bushel and a peck, you bet your pretty neck I do. Doodle-loodle-loodle, doodle-loodle-loodle, doodle-loodle-loodle. Come on, girls!
Now, I can see that calming me down and putting a smile on my face, but I don't know if it would put my kids to sleep.
If you're rocking and bouncing while you do it, yeah, I could see it.
Well, let's talk about some of those pop songs that you mentioned. Give us an example of one where there was a raging discussion about the lyrics.
Well, the one that I actually had never heard was I Kissed a Girl, which is a British pop song about a homosexual relationship. But if you're singing it to a little girl, I kissed a girl. So there was a lot of discussion about whether or not you're influencing your child for life based on singing these lyrics. There was Guns N' Roses, Sweet Child of Mine, was a huge one from Guns N' Roses.
Let's just listen to that for a second. This would be an example of lyrics that really work, but I mean, it's hard to imagine that one putting a child to sleep, although we are talking about parents who are singing to their children
right,
as opposed to a full band.
Or more to the point, I don't understand how some people sang some of these songs. I mean, some of them are hard to sing. Whitney Houston, I Will Always Love You. I mean, if your standard is Whitney Houston and you're trying to reach those notes and bring that to the nursery, my goodness.
Love you.
That feels like a lullaby. Though.
I can hear it. I actually think the nursery is kind of an American Idol studio for a lot of moms.
I couldn't sing it. Could not sing it.
But
absolutely,
anything.
It's a perfect song. Or James Blunt with You're Beautiful. Again, a tough song to sing. but an appropriate song.
Do you get an image of mom sort of
or dad,
you know, jumping around, or dad?
Or dad.
That's right.
There were
right.
a lot of dads on this website. I mean, I'm interested that you started with a dad calling in. There were a lot of dads on this website. This was in this particular discussion. This is not just mothers singing.
Did dads have different suggestions than moms? Different style? Different
didn't times? Track it. I bet yeah. they did. Mm-hmm. I would bet much more of the country music came from the dads. Much more of the bouncy music. It, you know, kind of my informal memory of what hundreds of people said on there was that. Yes, I think the dads probably sing slightly different songs.
Well,
were you
usual.
Surprised by the responses?
I would have been if 2,000 people hadn't responded in Britain.
Right.
But it was one of these things that when you say it, people just want to start telling you. And they want to, interestingly, not only talk about what they sing to their children, but they start remembering what was sung to them.
You're a host of the Life Work show, right?
Yeah, Life's Work with Lisa Belkin on XM,
thank
on
you.
Satellite, on Sirius XM. I forget that's Sirius XM now.
And Life's Work, Confessions of an Unbalanced Mom. Thank you, Lisa.
Hard to see how that song could be sung to a child.
Oh, give me a pillow. I'm ready.
We're turning to Femi. She's going to wake us up with all the headlines this morning. Femi.
Good morning. The time is 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Former top execs from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac go before a House committee today. Internal documents suggest they knew their loans were risky. Speaker Nancy Pelosi says the House will have an economic stimulus bill by early January. She said they're working on the bill right now. Violence has surged in fighting between Mexico's drug cartels. The number of casualties has gone up twice since last year. The airline's main trade group says that the industry is going to keep losing money. They expect to lose $2.5 billion next year. And it's a birthday today, 40th birthday. The computer mouse is 40 years old. And the original idea came from a team at the Stanford Research Institute in California. So on December the 9th, 1968, the first computer mouse was demonstrated at a computer conference. It was chunky and wooden with a single button. And how far we've come today.
And paid for by taxpayer dollars.
It was a NASA contract. That
it
seems
was
to
a
irk
NASA.
You.
It does irk me. We paid for the mouse. And when I buy a computer, I pay again for the mouse. And when I buy another computer, I pay again for the mouse.
Back then, the mouse was... as big as three houses. Now it's much smaller.
You exaggerate slightly, like a garage.
It's typical. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. It's The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And you know, I still have those lullabies, those kind of new age. I mean, actually, new age is wrong.
Is that in quotes, lullabies?
Well, lullabies for the leaders of tomorrow. And Lisa Belkin, our guest, who wrote about what parents are singing to their kids. And it's actually pretty
surprising. On the New York
surprising.
Times website, Motherload.
Right, Motherload. And, you know, I remember what my parents sang to me. And I remember what I... you know, sometimes had spotty success getting my kids to fall asleep with it, and we were getting tons more.
My name is Carmela. I'm from Long Island, and I would sing Sweet Baby James to my boys as a lullaby, but I would change James to their name, of course, so that it felt more personal.
Rock-a-bye, Sweet Baby Jane.
Well, that works.
Yeah, that's very
I mean,
sweet.
Yeah.
And calming and soothing.
Well, there must be something about when you're a little kid seeing the song that your mom loves that is reassuring on some level, or your dad loves.
Right, you know. Exactly. Thanks for including dads, because my dad is a hummer, and he's Nigerian. He loves Nigerian music, world music.
He hums.
A
he
lot of them
hummer.
Are musically based.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
So he
right.
kind of hums it, and to this day, it's very comforting.
It's very comforting.
Mm-hmm.
Even if your dad's favorite song is, you know, like James Brown.
Yes, hello. In response to the lullaby project, what I would sing to my kids if I had any for a lullaby, well, Cold Sweat by James Brown. How's that one?
I wake up in a cold sweat.
Yeah.
If you want them to be up all night.
Get up and have some cereal. That's it. Get up. and eat these bananas. That's right. Yeah, maybe there's a reason why he doesn't have any kids. But I like his nomenclature. It's the Lullaby Project that we got you all involved in. This was actually a suggestion on Lisa's website.
No, there was a whole discussion. She said many people actually like this song. It's just hard to imagine people who are not singers attempting this. Can you see that?
I can, actually.
Imagine that?
I mean, when you're a parent and you got to get the child to sleep, I mean, you're in a desperate state. You'll do anything. I mean, standing there in your underwear, screaming out Guns N' Roses, I can totally see it. And I have four kids, so, you know, we got a big band in our house. A lot of voices in the choral section there. Show tunes were actually high on the list here.
Yeah, this is DeJohn from Queens. I used to sing my daughter to sleep with Tomorrow from the stage play Annie.
The sun will come out tomorrow, so you gotta hang on till tomorrow.
It's actually the second time we've played that song this month on the show. It's popular on many, many levels.
But it's interesting, like extremes, right? Some of these folky Taylor songs, Annie, very folksy, and then you got the rock and roll way on the other side of things. What do you think that says? Because when I was a kid, nobody was belting out Jimi Hendrix.
Well, you know,
or The Doors.
I mean, it's hard to know where actual lullabies came from. And as we pointed out in our conversation with Lisa Belkin, you know, Ring Around the Rosie is about the plague. So the source of these can be anywhere.
My name is Tracy, and I'm calling from New York, New York. And the reason why young parents are singing A Bushel and a Peck to their children is because Dan Zanes has it on one of his CDs.
I love you, a bushel and a peck. A bushel and a peck and a hug around the neck. A hug around the neck and a barrel and a heap. A barrel and a heap and I'm talking in my sleep about you.
Dan Zanes, he's huge. You'll find out.
I will?
Yeah.
Okay.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, December 9th. Femi OK has joined us and she's got the morning headlines.
Good morning. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Many world markets are slightly higher today. Japan's Nikkei index closed up this morning. European markets are mostly up as well. Futures trading on the Dow shows investors expecting a basically flat opening. Congress and the White House are working to iron out a deal that could give $15 billion in loans to the big three car makers. The current package would also include a so-called car czar, a government watchdog to monitor how automakers spend the money. And there could be a vote on the package as soon as Wednesday. Greece is again erupting with riots. Today is the funeral of the teenage boy killed by police. The weekend shooting sparked protests around the nation, some of which turned fiery and violent. Two police officers involved with the shooting are under arrest and one faces murder charges. At least three are dead after an American fighter jet crashed into a San Diego home. Rescuers fear another child may be buried in the wreckage. The search resumes today. The pilot ejected and landed safely. The Pentagon isn't yet sure what went wrong with the flight. And the funeral of Alexei II was held this morning. The service for the head of the Russian Orthodox Church took place at the Cathedral of Christ the Savior in Moscow, Russia. The Patriarch died on Friday, aged 79, and he was the leader of the world's largest Orthodox Christian denomination. And that's a look at some of the stories making news this morning.
Thank you very much, Femi.
Now we're going to take a look at food stamps and what's happening here in the U.S. In September, the number of people on food stamps was well over 31 million. That's the highest participation level on record, and it translates into one out of 10 Americans.
Another reminder that all these economic indicators have human beings behind them.
Oh, and serious consequences. It's hard to believe that. 10% of the population is now turned to food stamps. Ellen Vollinger knows it well. She is the legal food stamp director for the Food Research and Action Center, and she joins us now. Good morning, Ellen, and welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
So what in the world is happening?
Well, in September, there were two major factors that pushed food stamp usage as high as it got. One is the continuing weak economy, which is affecting people all across the country. There's no state that's not experiencing some level of difficulties. And for many, they've been in recession for quite a while and are seeing very big problems for people struggling, having enough income to afford nutritious food for their families. But one other factor also occurred in September, and those were hurricanes in the Gulf region, Hurricane Ike and Gustav. And one of the hallmarks of the federal food stamp program is that it is responsive to increases in need. So as the economy is weakened or as natural disasters kicked in, the food stamp program is structured so that it will expand in times of growing need, and that's precisely what happened in September.
So is that a sign that everything's working, that the system is great, or is this an alarming statistic that conceals maybe some other problems in the economy?
I'd say it's both a structure that's working and an alarming trend. The food stamp program is a federal entitlement program. In 1996, when Congress was considering welfare reform, there were actually proposals to change that structure, block grant it, and give states a fixed sum of money. Fortunately, Congress rejected that proposal. If it had adopted that and states had been stuck with fixed pots of money, we wouldn't see the ability for these benefits to kick in and help people who are struggling with unemployment, underemployment, or in areas like the Gulf Coast states where they were hit with that sudden hurricane problem. So the structure of the food stamp program is sound. That's the good news. The bad news is how weak the economy is and how low benefit levels are. The food stamps that people get will help them, but they only help them through part of the month because they're set at too low a benefit level amount. And we've been asking Congress, particularly given the weakness in the economy, to help jumpstart the economy and help those struggling families by including a benefit increase in food stamps, which, by the way, are now called Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, to go ahead and give a boost in those benefit levels as part of the stimulus economic recovery package.
And Ellen, and those are for people who are eligible. So let's step back for a second. I was surprised by the numbers, essentially because eligibility has become much harder in the last 10 years. Who is eligible for food stamps today?
Well, it's a national program, and so the income levels are set nationally. If you are a household of three, your net income for food stamps would probably be about $18,000. That means you could have a higher gross income, but once they look at your expenses, if you have high shelter costs, high rent expenses, high utilities, high child care costs, they're going to take those into account, and that may help you qualify. In addition, some states have taken options under the federal program to actually make it easier, especially for working families, to get those benefits. That's true in New York State. It's recently true in Ohio, Pennsylvania. So families really, if they're feeling that they're having a struggle making ends meet, they may want to check out either through the helpline that USDA has nationally, 1-800-221-5689, or they can go on our website, www.frac.org, and they can actually get linked to a tool which will help them pre-screen and determine whether or not their circumstances are such that they can qualify.
And you're talking about families. What about individuals, single people, men or women?
Well, it's a sliding scale in terms of eligibility. The income that you're allowed to have is varied according to whether you're a one-person household or a larger household. And how much you're going to get in benefits also varies not only according to your household side, but also to what your particular low-income circumstances are. The best way for people to check and see whether or not they might be eligible before even pursuing the process would be to check and go on the USDA website and pre-screen themselves. Again, we have a link on our website to that tool. You just go in and answer a few questions, and it will give you a pretty good idea whether or not you qualify, and then you could decide whether or not to pursue the process. But we're missing a lot of people in this country who are eligible. The most recent statistics show that one out of every three people who's eligible for food stamps has not been getting them.
Wow.
So that's a lot of people out there that just probably don't know that they're eligible or may not know how to go about obtaining the help, but it is there for them. We would encourage them to get it if they need it, in particular because they will actually bring federal dollars into their local communities that'll go through grocery stores and help the local economy. So first and foremost, they should do it to make sure they have the resources to feed themselves and their families. But frankly, they will be doing
right.
a good thing for the local economy if they pursue it as well.
Ellen, quickly before we go, is there still a stigma associated with food stamps in the sense that people are ashamed to show them in the grocery market? But with 31 million people on food stamps, stigma for 1 in 10 people would seem to be going away.
Well, we think that there's been a lot done in this program to modernize it and to take away the stigma that was associated with coupons. For one thing, people redeem their benefits by using an ATM-like debit card. It's called an electronic benefit
transfer
card.
So no one knows.
Yeah, and so it's very much a mainstream experience, and states are working very hard with the federal government to try to get the word out that this is a nutrition program, it's there for people, try to ease the process for them. They need to work harder at it, frankly. There's more work to be done, but it is modernizing, and hopefully, particularly with the new federal name for the program, SNAP, Supplemental
right.
Nutrition Assistance Program, that notion of coupons will be from a bygone day.
Ellen Vollinger, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Ellen Vollinger is the legal food stamp director for the Food Research and Action Center. And interestingly enough, we just got a quick email from one of our listeners who said we didn't really get to the issue of how much you get in benefits. That
right.
is really not enough to feed a family of four.
Well, she says it definitely needs to be raised, that's for sure. As usual, you're joining our conversation, particularly about coming up with a new name for the car czar.
How about the four-wheel big deal? And I think the new name for the car czar should be the Ogre.
My recommendation is Autocrat.
How about Motor Mouth or Wheeler Dealer?
We're also talking about lullabies you sing to your kids today. We want to hear what the new generation is putting is going to sleep by.
Hi, this is Pat Carter in New Jersey. Both of my daughters, who are now 14 and 7, were sung to sleep with Luther Vandross's If This World Were Mine.
Oh, that's
I'm not
a good
singing.
One.
If this world were mine.
Wake up, Adora.
I love this song. That's a good
place
one.
At your feet.
Our listener Jane told us she sings Morning Town Ride by the Seekers. Very, very different suggestion, I think.
Very, very different.
Sing us a lullaby at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
A global economy with no sea legs. A key index of world shipping is showing an alarming decline. Commerce floats on a sea of worldwide demand and letters of credit. When recession drains the oceans, the ships stay in port. At least that's how it works on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, December 9th, and I think you're referring to something called the Baltic Dry Index. Would that be right?
That is correct. Good morning, Adora.
Honestly, I never heard of it until a couple of days ago, but we have more on it today. It is very important, and we'll explain why. Also, a discussion about whether President-elect Obama wants to nationalize the auto industry as that debate continues on Capitol Hill. And the international community, well, they're looking for some solutions on global warming. Those stories are coming up, but first, these headlines.
Congress and the White House are in final negotiations on a loan package for automakers. It could be around $15 billion, so return on investment seems to be a big concern. Here's President Bush speaking on Nightline.
Anything that's done would, as best as possible, guarantee the taxpayers get their money back. In other words, there needs to be viability.
One viability idea gaining steam is appointing a so-called car czar. This government watchdog would monitor what carmakers do with taxpayer money. A vote could come Wednesday. Electronics giant Sony is going to cut 8,000 jobs, about 5% of its global workforce, and that's going to shut down 10% of Sony's plants around the world.
And investigators are trying to figure out why a fighter jet crashed in California yesterday.
We don't know exactly what was the cause and the problem he was having, and that's we'll be conducting a thorough safety investigation to find that out.
That's Colonel Chris O'Connor. The Pentagon wants to know why the jet crashed into a San Diego home, killing at least three people. The pilot was able to eject to safety. Greece is again erupting with riots. Today is the funeral of the teenage boy killed by police. The weekend shooting sparked protests all over the country. Some turned fiery and violent. Two police officers involved with the shooting are under arrest. One faces murder charges.
Laid-off Chicago workers are staying put at Republic Door and Window, their former workplace. They're occupying the company to fight for severance and unused vacation pay. The company and Bank of America blame each other for the unpaid workers. The company claims they can't pay because the bank canceled financing. The union, company, and bank all meet today.
Pakistan is making good. They have reportedly arrested more than 20 people on suspicion of ties to the Mumbai attacks. The country is promising trials and punishment on its soil for any terrorists.
Wall Street opens at the bottom of the hour. Looks like a flat opening, although the futures have turned south, at least for the last few minutes. What title would you give the soon-to-be-appointed car czar? Our friend Todd Zwillick suggests these, Lemonhead, Autocrat, but we want to hear yours.
Hi, John and the Dora. This is David from Putnam, Connecticut. Hey, I got the acronym for you. I think it should be NAG, National Automotive Guru.
Thanks, Dave. I love how we're on a first-name basis with all our listeners, with every single one of
we
them.
We are, though.
Try that, Morning Edition. Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Even
or my
you
take
chuckled.
At thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
But we don't want government to run companies. Generally, government historically hasn't done that very well.
President-elect Barack Obama talking about an auto rescue plan over the weekend on NBC. And clearly the track record of the government running companies is a problem, but obviously it's because the government doesn't have a decent czar to run the companies it's taken over in the past. The auto industry is looking for a $15 billion bailout, and part of it would be apparently a car czar to run the details of that agreement. But we hate the car czar name anyway. What's your suggestion for the name of this character? 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Wanted. One car czar to take over a multi-billion dollar problem. Failure apparently is an option. Joining us is David Sanger from the New York Times. David, you talk about this idea of government industrial takeovers in a piece on nationalization in the Times. Do we need a czar to nationalize an industry? And if not, what would you suggest?
Now, you know, we invented nationalized industries before we invented czars. But, you know, as long as you've been doing this competition on czars, I had just two modest suggestions to make for you, John.
Please, please.
The first is that we ought to go to the president of Pakistan and see if he would be interested in taking up the job. Because
I can't wait to hear this,
David. Czar whose name is Zardari.
Car czar Zardari. Ooh.
That would work.
Yeah.
And it might be more pleasant than the job he's got right now, which is, you know, difficult enough as it is.
Right.
But, you know, we're going to have so many czars in Washington that at the inauguration now, they're going to have a little separate section for, you know, even Iraq and Afghanistan czar. There's long been a drug czar. We now may have a car czar. We're soon
Karzai could be a car czar. We could take
right.
Karzai from Afghanistan.
Oh. That's ooh.
Yeah,
But soon we're going to need an American Association of Czars.
Well, we want everyone to call it 877-8-MY-TAKE to come up with a new czar name. But let's talk seriously about this nationalization issue. What is the track record? Barack Obama suggests it isn't very good in taking over industrial companies, but what is it?
Well, John, it's miserable. And think about what the past 30 years have been about. The past 30 years have been about privatizing national industries. National train systems, national airlines, national tobacco companies. The whole idea has been let's get government out of these because the fact of the matter is governments are not very good at reacting to market signals. Now, I spent 6 years for the Times in Japan at a time that they were actually moving away from nationalization. And there's a lot in the proposal that is now circulating through Congress that reminds me of the days when I would cover the Ministry of International Trade and Industry, which was the giant bureaucracy that came together and helped assemble the world's most successful car industry, the Japanese car industry. But even many in that industry, including Suichiro Honda, the founder of Honda, came to the conclusion that government planners don't come up with many new ideas for cars or anything else.
But aren't we talking about a temporary measure, David? And really, what is the alternative?
You are talking about a temporary measure, but we don't know how temporary. At the opening, you referred to $15 billion. That $15 billion is to get us through the next couple of months. What we're talking about in the way of infusions to really restructure the car industry, $15 billion will be, you know, a pint of oil in this engine.
Right. Well, the $15 billion is to get GM through the next couple of weeks. It isn't even months at that point. But what about the U.S. government takeover of Lockheed back, I believe, in the 70s? It restructured the defense industries. Is the fact that the government was also the chief buyer of defense products the key reason why that seemed to work at Lockheed so long ago?
We have had individual companies that this has worked to some degree with. Obviously, there was the Chrysler bailout, which the United States made money on. There was the Lockheed case. I mentioned in the story this morning the steel seizure case, which came out of something different. It was President Truman literally seizing the steel mills because of a threatened strike. And he did this under presidential powers that the Supreme Court soon ruled did not exist. But in this case, we're discussing a much longer-term transformation of an entire industry, or I should say part of an industry. And this is part of the difficulty that the incoming administration has not addressed. We have an overall car industry in the United States. It's made up partly of the big three and partly of companies like Toyota, Honda, BMW, Mercedes, others who have built factories in the United States, employed Americans, and made a profit doing it, proving that it can be done, right? They are not being offered the same kind of deal now. You might say, well, of course not. They're the ones who have been beating the big three here. But we have been going around the world for three decades as a country, insisting that other nations treat American companies the same way they treat their own national country.
And we'll be violating that principle if we put this bailout into work.
We will be. And what happens when China and France and many others turn around and do the same to our company?
You know what frustrates me, though, in looking at this debate here, and we were talking about this morning before we went on the air, is that once again, fairly straightforward, complicated, but still straightforward economics gets clouded and messed up with a bunch of moralizing about nationalization is bad, some sort of puritanical stigma about getting involved. It seems that Congress is just sort of holding its nose and doing this in a way that ensures failure.
Well, we don't know if it's going to ensure failure or not. I mean, it's very understandable, given the political atmosphere now and given the record of the auto industry in not paying attention to calls for reform in the past, that if taxpayers are going to pay this money, they will want to, as President-elect Obama said, make sure that the auto companies aren't coming back in a few months for more because they haven't fundamentally changed. And yet you can't fundamentally change the companies without setting huge conditions on these loans. And that's what gets you into the nationalization paradox.
I mean, but here's the problem, David. Lawmakers, the industry, bankers, have all been complicit in the journey the automakers have been on for the last couple of decades.
That's right.
To hold your nose at this point is absurd. The industry is in trouble. The question is, what can be done or not by the government to set it in a new direction? Given your experience and the stories that you've covered, what do you think should be the priority and the steps taken by the federal government to move forward?
I think the first thing we need to do is try to establish here what it is we are trying to accomplish. Are we trying to save the companies? Are we trying to save the jobs? Or lastly, are we just trying to buy ourselves some time so that we don't have bankruptcies and layoffs at a moment of recession that could, you know, further push us over the edge?
And Congress hasn't really been clear on what it is
they
we
have
are
not
doing.
Been. Read that bill. You can't tell. So
right.
If you want to save the companies, then you do something like what you're doing. If you want to save the jobs, then you may go out, including to foreign buyers, and say, are there facilities here that you would be willing to buy if you promise us that you're going to keep people employed, maybe on different terms, but you're going to keep them employed?
But then a third scenario would be something maybe on the order of the campaign rhetoric that we heard, particularly from Barack Obama, a kind of Manhattan project to basically fund a fundamentally new kind of solution to the transportation problem, a exotic, even beyond electric car kind of thing, you know, that would mirror the moonshot.
That's a fabulous idea, but it's a long-term solution that you certainly need. But we also have a short-term crisis that it wouldn't address. And so you probably have to go do both. Now, President Bush's approach to this was early in his term, he asked the American car makers to come out and put, you know, their hydrogen cars and so forth out on the South Lawn. And he walked around these prototypes and said how great it was and sent them on their way. And the amount of funding that we have put into advanced energy research in the past few years has been relatively tiny as a government. And so those cars aren't a whole lot closer to production. So what you're discussing is a great long-term project, I think the ultimate long-term project, because it gets to energy and the environment and so forth, freedom from Middle East oil and so forth. It's not going to help you if you're a line worker in Flint, Michigan right now, worried about whether your job's around in a month.
Point well taken. David Sanger, as usual, thank you so much for joining us. David Sanger is a New York Times reporter in the Washington Bureau talking about nationalization and the track record of the U.S. and the complexity of the debate on nationalization. And David Sanger isn't the only person that hates the car czar idea.
Hi, this is Kevin Jones calling from Brooklyn, New York, and I believe that the auto bailout person should be known as the autoimmune systems.
The autoimmune systems. There's a good one for you.
That's pretty good. Here's one that it requires some knowledge of the Ford Motor Company.
It's Frank in Pleasantville. The car czar has got to be named Edsel Pinto because it can't help but be a disaster.
Two troubled
Such
Ford
confidence.
Products there. Keep them coming at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. We begin with a story that the Chicago Tribune is reporting on its website. A source reportedly told the Tribune that Governor Blagojevich of Illinois was taken into federal custody at his Northside home this morning. The U.S. Attorney's Office has not confirmed it. Apparently, it is something involved with activities unrelated to the strike that we've been reporting on that's been going on there.
But it's related to federal corruption charges. He's been investigated. Correct. He was being investigated. Right. So the charges are likely to be related to that.
Right. Unconfirmed by the U.S. Attorney's Office, so we're following that. But we continue in this segment to talk about a conference that's begun in Poland about climate change.
Can you really mobilize international financial resources in a time of economic crisis and in a time of economic downturn? Now, that is a critical question because finance, money, is at the heart of finding a long-term solution to the issue of climate change.
That's Ivo de Boer, the executive secretary of the UN Framework on Climate Change, and he's in Poland today, along with hundreds of other world leaders. They're meeting to continue to hammer out a blueprint for a global response to global warming. While the U.S. is in the midst of political transition and world markets have plummeted, what can they accomplish? We talked earlier with BBC correspondent Matt McGrath. He's in Poland, about what's on the agenda.
Well, what the people are trying to do here is to come up with a significant plan that will allow the world to tackle climate change, and they have to do this by the end of 2009 and to get something in place that will replace the Kyoto Protocol, which a lot of the world, apart from America, has signed up to. And so there's 10,000 delegates here from 187 countries all negotiating away. They're about to be joined by their environment ministers to try and hammer out a negotiating document, if you like, that over the next 12 months they will put the information in place that will form the basis of a new treaty. That's what they're trying to do here, but it's not easy and it won't happen overnight.
It would be easy to say that perhaps the conference is irrelevant on some levels given the financial concerns, but also more importantly that you don't have high-level delegations from China and you have confusion about who's really representing the United States while you're there. But there has been some progress made, and let's start with the science. Generally speaking, there is a consensus about global warming being a problem and what the causes are.
Yeah, we feel here kind of in Europe that we've moved on the science situation. Last year we had the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change producing several reports that really hammered home the basic details. You know, the temperature of the world is rising. It's principally caused by man's activities, and we have to tackle it over a time period. Emissions have to start coming down within the next 10 years. That's the bottom line, basically. And the politicians pretty much all accept that. But the problem here is, as you rightly say, there are a lot of lame ducks on the ground here. We have not just the American delegation, but the Europeans are also looking around and saying, well, we were supposed to be the leaders on climate change, but we're now having problems with some of our countries, like Poland and the other Eastern European countries, who are not so keen on the plans that have been put in place. So there's a little bit of everybody waiting to see. It's a bit like that Samuel Beckett play, Waiting for Godot. You know, there's not a...
Oh, here
you know,
come the metaphors. So these are like lame ducks in the coal mine kind of thing?
Canaries in the coal mine, I think. Yeah, the lame ducks wouldn't go anywhere near it, I think. But it is a bit waiting for this. But not a great deal happening here. Everyone is quite miserable, and I think everybody's hoping that the president-elect and his new team will inject a lot of energy into this process next year and drive it forward to a successful conclusion. That's the plan, at least.
And there are great expectations of President-elect Barack Obama, right? Many are looking to him to set the international agenda.
Oh, absolutely. I think there isn't a single delegation here who doesn't really look forward to the Obama administration as injecting some fresh life into this process and moving on from positions that have become quite entrenched. However, how much movement President Obama's team will be able to do is a different question, because many people here feel that he will have to get significant amounts of legislation through Congress in the United States before he's able to sign up to any international climate deal. And he will only have a period of 9-10 months in which to do that. And he has a few other things on his tray at the moment. So there's a lot of expectations that he will do something, but there's, I suppose, a practical awareness that he may have his hands tied in some ways as well.
But speaking practically, this conference in Poland right now is really leading up to the big one, which is next year in Copenhagen, right?
That's absolutely right. Yeah, they started this process in Bali in Indonesia 12 months ago. They've moved it here to Poland now. Next year it goes to Copenhagen, where it's all supposed to be finished. The problem is that it's a hugely complicated and complex process, and trying to get agreement amongst 187 countries on what to do, how to set a long-term target, how to tackle it, and most importantly, who pays for all of it, that's really, really difficult to do. And of course, as you say, there's a lot of emphasis coming on the finance now, because we're getting to the crunch questions of actually who is going to pay for stopping the emissions rising and to stopping the damage being happening in many parts of the world.
Well, last question. What do you think can reasonably be accomplished in Poland in this go-round?
I think the bottom line would be that they don't fall off the wagon, that they at least keep going, keep negotiating. They get a kind of an outline, big text that may be 80 to 100 pages that everybody's got their opinions on, and that will form the basis of negotiation. If they get that and they get a new president coming in and new people here in Europe, perhaps on a more unified front, then that may well be enough to satisfy people here that they can move forward to a real treaty next year. But there's a lot of people who are saying, you know, we may get a treaty next year, but it may be very, very small scale. It may be just an agreement among people to continue negotiating, which would be a big disappointment. And the scientists would say it would be too little, too late.
Matt Analogy McGrath, that's what we're going to start calling him, is a BBC correspondent who joined us from the climate conference in Poland.
And if you don't like the idea of a car czar overseeing the auto rescue plan, what's your alternative?
This is Mark Brown in New Jersey. We don't need a car czar. The automobile industry in the United States is dead. We need someone to take the Detroit 3 from an automobile industry into a transportation industry.
So an undertaker, I guess. 877-8-MY-TAKE or my take at thetakeaway.org. And now headlines from Femi. Okay.
Hello there. The time is just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. Markets in Europe are up modestly today. That's despite expectations for modest losses on Wall Street. Now, no matter what you think of the car czar title, a top-ranking GM executive likes it. Robert Lutz, who's a GM vice president, said that he's happy with the plan being discussed by Congress. The car czar will oversee how the failing auto companies use federal funds, and the position is part of a $15 billion package being hashed out today in Washington. Five Blackwater guards have been charged with 14 counts of manslaughter in Washington. 17 civilians died when the guards opened fire in Baghdad last fall. Blackwater says that the guards were acting in self-defense. Prosecutors say the violence was unprovoked. The man accused of engineering the 9/11 attacks wants to plead guilty. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and four other defendants at Guantanamo Bay asked to enter a plea yesterday. And that was after relatives of victims from the 9/11 attacks were allowed into the courtroom for the first time. Sally Regenhardt's son Christian was a firefighter who died in the World Trade Center on 9/11.
For the families of the victims, there has been no justice. There's been no accountability or responsibility on any level.
The defendants, if found guilty, will face the death penalty. And that's a look at some of the big stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We begin with a couple of details. The markets have opened negative on Wall Street. Unexpectedly, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 2%. And CBS is now reporting, a number of news organizations in Chicago are now reporting a Chicago Tribune story, which quotes a single source indicating that Governor Rod Blagojevich has been taken into custody by federal agents based on a investigation of Blagojevich's so-called pay-to-play activities. A corruption scandal has possibly resulted in an arrest. We are watching it. But so far, the Tribune is the only one with a source on the story, but other news organizations are starting to report it. Meanwhile, we are going to shift to an economic indicator, which is actually a pretty important indication of what's going on in the world economy, because the ships on the seas of this world carry the raw materials that are the lifeblood of economic growth. And huge ships that take care of everything from pork bellies to oil are tracked. backed by a key economic indicator called the Baltic Dry Index. It's been around since 1744, and the chief executive of the Baltic Exchange, where the index is compiled in London, is Jeremy Penn. And as a broad indicator of economic growth, you couldn't do better than this index. Jeremy, thanks for being part of the program.
Good morning. It's a pleasure.
Now, the Baltic Dry Index, which is a very interesting economic indicator of the state of demand for raw materials of all kinds, is off its lows this morning. It's up 8 points, a rise of about 1.5%, I guess. What is the Baltic Dry Index measuring, and how important is its fluctuation?
Well, that fluctuation, to answer your second question first, is actually a very small fluctuation. I mean, you can take it that the index is still at near to historic lows. But what it measures is the cost of what we call dry bulk shipping. So it incorporates the costs of a range of vessel sizes. The very biggest ones are 170,000 tons, and they're used almost exclusively for shipping coal and iron ore around. They're called Capesize ships, and their health really reflects the health of the steel industry and, to a lesser extent, the electricity generation industry.
There are two components of the Baltic Dry Index, it seems to me, and maybe I have this wrong, so go ahead and correct me, but there's one part of it that relates to demand for commodities, which indicates sort of whether there's a building going on in the case of copper or the steel industry, as you mentioned, but there's also an element of the volume of shipping that relates to letters of credit that are available for shippers to actually insure their cargoes and finance their cargoes, and when that dries up, there's also a problem of shipping. Are the historic lows that we're seeing now due to the lack of credit or the lack of demand?
I think fundamentally it's the lack of demand. But over the last few weeks, let's say the last couple of months, there clearly have been some issues over establishing credit for cargoes. Receivers who would normally have had credit extended to them by the shippers, the dispatchers of the cargoes, are being asked now to provide letters of credit, etc., where perhaps they wouldn't have done in the past. And you're finding that banks are charging, in some cases, a slightly higher rate for a letter of credit, or they're more difficult to organize, etc. So there have been issues, anecdotally, regarding letters of credit and credit generally. But that shouldn't obscure the fact that what's driven down the index has been a sudden and dramatic reduction in world trade in raw materials. And that's, we talked about the big ships, it's coal and iron ore there, but it's also in the cases of the smaller ships, finished steels, fertilizers, other forms of ore, mm-hmm. so specialist metal ores, etc., and grain, of course.
Jeremy, when I first learned about this, and to be honest, it was through one of our listeners, actually, who mentioned it. But I think there's some great irony here that this very basic measurement says a lot about where the world economy is. And I was just wondering, when you're tracking how the exchange is doing, does it essentially foreshadow what's to come in the real or investment markets before it happens?
Well, I think there are certainly a number of economists who think that's true. But if you look at what happened this year, there was some kind of quite big distortions brought into the shipping market because of certain factors around the supply of iron ore to China, the price negotiations between the Chinese and the Australians, and then subsequently the Chinese and the Brazilians, changed the distribution of ships and the distribution of requirements for ships, which meant that there was a lot of demand in the summer at a time when perhaps things were actually already starting to slow down. But I think when you look at it today, the truth is, if you look at the Baltic Dry Index and you say to yourself, what does this tell me about the world economy? It's pretty depressing. And,
right.
and it is the right question to be asking, because it's saying, well, how much demand is there for steel? How much demand is there from the emerging markets for grains? You know, how much world trade is being conducted, or rather, how much has world trade slowed down over the last few months? And the answer is, you know, the picture's not very attractive.
Jeremy, finally, before we go, just quickly, how do you assemble the index? Do you call up shippers? I mean, it's an interesting sort of data.
The index is taken from an average of rates for very, very specific routes, specific shipping trades, where we get the data from independent brokers who are working for commission. So they don't have any money in the market themselves. They operate working for commission, and they're experts in the routes they report to us on, and they're all members of the Baltic Exchange.
That's great. Jeremy Penn is chief executive of the Baltic Exchange. Thanks so much for joining us, Jeremy.
It's a pleasure.
Jeremy was on the line from London. And now headlines from Femi Oke.
Thank you very much. 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Oil prices edged down in trading in London today. Investors are questioning whether a big production cut by OPEC can bring the price up. The price has plummeted 70% in the last 5 months. And getting this news in, I know, John, you've been talking about this in the last 10 minutes or so. Getting confirmation now from Associated Press, the U.S. Attorney's Office, the Illinois Governor Loguevich arrested on unspecified federal charges. I'll bring you more in the next 10 minutes or so on that case.
Yeah, there's something very, I have to find out that story that they went and arrested a sitting governor at his home very early or overnight. That's
Governor's
unusual.
Office not commenting right now, and the original source came from the Chicago Tribune, now getting a backup source from the Associated Press. I'll get you more information as much as I can in the next 10 minutes or so.
We should note that the governor has been under investigation for corruption charges for a period of years.
And this has been ongoing, absolutely right. Getting this news in also this hour from the BBC, our partners. Pakistan has said it will not hand over to India any suspects arrested in connection with last month's attacks in Mumbai that left more than 170 people dead. The government says that a suspected commander of a banned Islamic group, which India and the United States blame for the attacks, is among 16 people that have been detained so far. And that's a look at some of the big breaking news stories. I'll have more information for you in 10 minutes' time. See you.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. An announcement yesterday by the U.S. Attorney in Washington, D.C. noted a sea change in position by the Bush administration on independent contractors in Iraq. Five Blackwater guards were indicted for the deaths of 17 Iraqis.
None of the victims of this shooting was armed. None of them was an insurgent. Many were shot while inside civilian vehicles that were attempting to flee from the convoy. One victim was shot in the chest while standing in the street with his hands up. Another was injured from a grenade fired into a nearby girls' school.
That's U.S. Attorney Jeff Taylor. Blackwater has maintained that their guards were acting in self-defense. For more, we're joined now by Ginger Thompson, a New York Times reporter who's been covering the story. Good morning and welcome, Ginger.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
The announcement of this 35-count indictment, it really stirred or noted a different position. Why now?
Well, I think that's the big question. You know, when the Bush administration launched its war against Iraq, it used an unprecedented number of private security contractors in the war zone and pretty much sent them there without establishing rules to cover their actions there. In fact, the Coalition Provisional Authority, which had been established by the United States immediately after the invasion, granted immunity to most contractors stationed in Iraq. And so yesterday's indictments are, in fact, the government's first test of its authorities to hold these contractors accountable for crimes committed in overseas.
And that's really a critical component here as to whether or not the U.S. government can actually prosecute these independent contractors. The law is unclear. Explain that.
the law remains unclear. In 2000, the government passed the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act, which has been used to prosecute military personnel overseas. But that law does not cover contractors like those who are working for Blackwater and Nicer Square because they were assigned to the State Department. And so there have been attempts since then by Congress to close that loophole and to pass amendments to the MEJA, as it's called, to cover contractors working for other government agencies. In 2004, there was an amendment passed that held accountable private contractors whose work is considered to directly support Pentagon activities. And the prosecutors in this case will argue that that amendment covers these State Department contractors who fired in Nicer mm-hmm. Square.
So much, much more to come on this story. And just fascinating that the Bush administration would start prosecuting or trying to prosecute these independent contractors at the 11th hour. Ginger Thompson, New York Times reporter covering this story, many thanks to you.
Thank you.
And, of course, in the new agreement, the new status of forces agreement, there will be no more immunity for these independent contractors in Iraq.
It's been my impression, though, that the Bush administration actually exploits the gray area, the ambiguity in the law.
There's
to
no
have
question.
Contractors doing things that the Army couldn't do.
I that's exactly right, because they certainly created the legal framework for it.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, December 9th, and we want to get you caught up on the latest headlines. So Femi Oke has just joined us.
Hello there to you all. Good morning. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. I have a number of breaking news stories for you right now. Indian police release names, photographs of 9 dead Mumbai gunmen, and they say all of them are from Pakistan. Also breaking this out, we've had several reports this morning that the feds have Illinois Governor Rob Blagojevich under arrest. He's been under investigation for corruption. The repercussions of the arrest reach far beyond Chicago. The Illinois governor will appoint the successor to President-elect Barack Obama's Senate seat. The Chicago Tribune and Associated Press reports that the long-running corruption probe is also looking at the Senate selection process. Congress and the White House are working to iron out a deal that could give $15 billion in loans to the big three car makers. And the current package would also include a car czar, that's a government watchdog, to monitor how automakers spend the money. And there could be a vote on the package as soon as tomorrow. Pakistan has 20 more people under arrest on suspicion of ties to the Mumbai attacks. Now, an earlier arrest of a high-level terror leader has led to some tip-offs. Pakistan is still refusing to hand over any Pakistanis to India. It promises trials and punishment on its soil for any terrorists. 40 years ago today, the high-tech visionary Douglas Engelbart demonstrated a new computer accessory. It's a very old recording taken from a film presentation, but it's definitely worth a listen.
And in a second, we'll see the screen that he's working and the way the tracking spot moves in conjunction with movements of that mouse. I don't know why we call it a mouse. Sometimes I apologize. It started that way, and we never did change it.
It's a little echoey, it's a little old, but that was one of the first demonstrations of a wooden clunky mouse. And one of the people watching that first computer conference where the mouse was actually unveiled said, watching Dr. Engelbart work was like watching him deal lightning with both hands.
Computer mouse.
Yes.
40 years ago today.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, they used
Today's
to say that computers used to be as big as a house. I gather the first mouse wasn't as big as a house.
Right? It was slightly bigger than a mouse, perhaps as big
and
as a rat.
And just to the story in Illinois, that's going to be fascinating to see how that unfolds. A very, very rare occasion when the U.S. attorney is arresting somebody before the office opens.
Yeah, well, lots more to come out there, and recordings of conversations with Governor Blagojevich. So we're going to conclude this hour, however, by opening up America's briefing book for President-elect Barack Obama on the issue of intelligence gathering and management of the enormous intelligence service in the United States. Barack Obama is taking a look at his intelligence policy, and to help him with America's briefing book, we are joined by John McLaughlin, who is a former deputy director for the CIA. He joins us from Virginia. John McLaughlin, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
He's a senior research fellow at the Paul Nitze School of Advanced International Studies. There are two questions here, John McLaughlin. One is the management question of how intelligence is managed in the new system that was set up during the Bush administration, and then the quality of the intelligence that's received. Let's begin with the management question. Are you confident that the new Uber director of intelligence in the government is the best way to go here?
Well, just so your listeners understand exactly what this is a 2004 law that was passed to create something called a Director of National Intelligence. This is a person who oversees 16 agencies in the intelligence community. The law, however, did not give this individual a lot of authority. Only one of those 16 agencies reports directly to the individual. That's the CIA. So basically, the tough job here for the person in charge, that's Admiral Mike McConnell, retired, is to coordinate, that's an important word, coordinate the efforts of all of these agencies. And I would say the system is a work in progress. It's not yet fully established. It has made some progress. Some things have improved in the way we share information, in the way we gain information, and in the way we harmonize policies for hiring people and training them and so forth. But in the new administration, I think they will have to test drive this system, if you will, and decide whether it's delivering to them what they need.
Well, let's talk about the test drive for just a moment. There have been calls in Washington in op-eds and in policy statements around the Beltway for continuity in the intelligence gathering system. Does that argue for maintaining the current team, with the same argument applying to why Barack Obama kept Robert Gates at the Pentagon? Or should there be a change of personnel at the top level of the intelligence establishment?
Well, I try not to get into discussions of people, and I think in this case a fair answer would be that there probably isn't an overwhelming strategic reason to make changes in the top leadership of the community. There may be some other reason related to policies that people wish to change, but for the most part, the community, the intelligence business is working reasonably well, and this is a time when everything else is in flux in the world. There might be some merit in having continuity at that level.
John, when you say that it's working well, like by what measure, and how do we Americans know that?
Well, I think you have to look at a couple of. It's a difficult question to answer, because I understand what you're saying. In other words, few people have visibility into the intelligence business, so how would you know? Well, probably the broadest external measure on something like terrorism is that we haven't been attacked again. Terrorism is the kind of problem that you have to focus on relentlessly, aggressively, and if you don't, they'll come back at us. And so far, the United States, while remaining, I think, vulnerable, has not been attacked again. A couple of reasons for that. In order to defeat a terrorist movement, you have to do three things at least. You have to destroy the leadership, you have to deny it safe haven, and you have to change the conditions that give rise to the movement. Well, in this case, I don't think we've completed any of those three, but there has been enough aggressive action against terrorists. It's particularly important to people in New York City, I think, to keep them off balance and disrupted.
Plenty on the table for Barack Obama on the intelligence front. John McLaughlin there, former director, deputy director of the CIA. Thanks so much for joining us. And we turn now to the former managing editor of the Chicago Tribune, James Warren, on this developing story out of Illinois, Governor Blagojevich taken into custody after a long investigation on so-called pay-to-play corruption, which has apparently escalated this morning with the governor taken into custody. Jim Warren, thanks for joining us.
A pleasure. Who would have thought that there'd be something that so quickly could get the Chicago Tribune or Tribune Company's own bankruptcy off the front pages?
Exactly. Just announced right. yesterday. Well, what do you know about the investigation that's been proceeding for a while and the circumstances of this arrest this morning, which my co-host rightly notes is very, very unusual for a sitting public official?
Yeah, well, what one knows is that now for 2 or 3 years, there's been a huge amount of smoke, and one has assumed that there was fire that was going to lead to the governor's office. You've got something like 12 or 13 people who've been indicted, many of them convicted. You've had trials in which you had lots of evidence of kickbacks being part and parcel of the way one had to do business in the state of Illinois and involved people doing business on behalf of state teachers' pension fund and another big state board, little known to
most
people.
You have a former governor right now who's in prison.
You had a former governor who's been in prison. You had a previous Democratic governor long ago who was in prison. You had a previous a Republican governor long, long, long ago, Ogilvy, who spent time in prison. So, yeah, you've got a rich, rich bipartisan tradition of corruption in this state. And ironically, Rod Blagojevich, whom I got to know when he was a U.S. congressman, Democrat, who actually represented the district in which I live in, which is the district where Rahm Emanuel is now the current congressman.
So it's all very convoluted, and I wish we had a lot of time to talk to you, but we don't. But what makes it particularly sensational this morning is the suggestion in some of the reporting that somehow the governor was trying to go about appointing Obama's replacement in the Senate in some sort of disreputable way.
Yeah, that I don't get. There's been a huge amount of speculation about who he would pick. Yesterday, he had a lengthy meeting with one of the people who most wants the job, and I think was not necessarily a likely choice.
Well, one thing that's not speculative, though, Jim, is that the feds were apparently given permission to record his conversations about the pick. So there was some suspicion there, that's for sure.
Right, and there was a top aide named John Wyma, W-Y-M-A, who was in some fashion involved in the recording process. And Blagojevich yesterday, in fact, very openly and for the first time, you know, talked about and almost defiantly talked about
right.
the disclosure of the tape recording, saying, "Hey, I got nothing to hide."
Right. Well, there will be more information today. A news conference today from the U.S. Attorney's Office. The governor has denied any wrongdoing. Much more on this story. Jim Warren, former managing editor of the Chicago Tribune. Thanks for joining us on The Takeaway.
Thank you. I'm Adora Udoji, and you're John Hockenberry, and together we make up The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.